WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tom Hanks, played astronaut Jim Lovell in the movie Apollo 13. Now Hanks is back in outer space. He's the executive producer of a 12-part docudrama miniseries exploring America's Apollo space program. It's called From the Earth to the Moon, and it begins Sunday on HBO. The series starts with President Kennedy's 1961 challenge to send a man to the moon and ends in 1972 with the last moonwalk. Hanks directed the first episode and wrote the final one, but he doesn't appear as an actor. The miniseries is based in part on the book A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts. The author, Andrew Chaikin, who was a consultant on the series, is also with us. I asked Tom Hanks why he wanted to take on another project about the space program after starring in Apollo 13.
Because there were so many stories that were both anecdotal and inspirational that would never see the light of day in any other medium. And actually meeting a lot of the men who both worked in Houston and, by the way, who also flew and walked on the moon, I just kind of stumbled upon, naturally, this treasure trove of amazing amazing yarns, literally just gripping stories that that Apollo 13 rightfully captured as far as its mission went. But there were moments fraught with great drama, anxiety, and personal vision in Apollo's 12 through 17 and Apollo's 1 through 10. And I was just anxious in order to bring what I thought really was just a very cool story to the air in some medium that would provide the time.
Andrew Chaikin, why did you write A Man on the Moon, which is a history of the Apollo missions? What's your fascination with space?
Well, you know, I was one of these kids that was absolutely captivated by Apollo when it was happening. I mean, I grew up totally in love with the sky. I mean, I knew where the planets were when I was 5 years old. And I think it was probably Ed White's Walk in Space, you know, during the Gemini program that just totally hooked me on the astronauts. And every mission that would come on, I would be glued to the TV with, you know, models of the spacecraft and maps of the moon. And, you know, my parents had friends who worked in the TV industry, so I had press kits that they had gotten me. And I was following the missions as if I were, you know, somehow by magic that a 12-year-old kid could be part of NASA. You know, I did everything that I could possibly do to kind of create that illusion for myself. And, you know, I was lucky enough to meet some of the astronauts. My parents took me to Cape Kennedy for my 13th birthday and just by luck stayed at the motel where all the astronauts were staying. So I lived it. It was the most exciting thing that I could possibly imagine happening, and it was happening before my eyes. I mean, something that had been science fiction and that I had watched movies about was now coming true.
Tom Hanks, you had a $65 million budget for this 12-part series.
not to begin with. To begin with, we had a $45 million budget.
Well, I don't
know. God bless HBO.
It seems actually quite scary to me to have like a 12-part series on space travel to have to do with this, you know, really large budget for television, certainly. I mean, did you really want to take on that much?
There was no other way to do it. Before we even went forward with approaching HBO, we knew that this was going to be very expensive. And it wasn't the first thing that came out of my mouth in the very first meeting we had with Chris Albrecht, the executives there, but it was probably the second. I said, look, this is going to be, it's going to take at least 12 hours. Actually, back then it was 13 hours because we were going to attempt the Soviet space program as well, which fell through the cracks. We just couldn't do it. But those 12 hours, said, this is going to be very costly because it can't be anything but. We were cognizant of the fact that whether we do this well or whether we do this poorly, we will probably be the definitive dramatized version of this facet of our history. We will be the record of Apollo, whether we do a good job or bad job. And just by dint of that, we knew that special effects as well as locations and actors, the amount of people that we'd have to hire in order to do this was going to be very, very costly.
Tom Hanks, you directed the first episode, which is about the very beginning of the space program.
Yes.
John Kennedy's challenge to have a man on the moon by the end of the 60s. And that episode ends with the Gemini 8 mission that had to abort. Why did you decide to direct that particular episode?
Well, I knew that it was going to be problematic and that we were going to have to bust a bunch of rules as far as being a quote-unquote pilot episode for what a series is. There were there was an ocean of faces that we had to establish and yet not linger on very long in order to get anybody to know. And there was a huge volume of information that we just needed to lay down. In show business parlance, it's called shoe leather or pipe. You have to, like, essentially set the stage for what is our real story. There's not a single Apollo launch in the first episode. It's all one Mercury mission and four Gemini missions that are by and large forgotten. And I felt as though that with as long as script that constantly stayed in flux right up until we were actually until just last December, where we shot some extra scenes for it in order to flesh it out, I knew that there was going to be this odd and undefined sort of logic that would have to be established by this first episode. And I honestly didn't know what it was. I couldn't give that over to a screenwriter or a director and say, listen, I know what this thing is, but go off and shoot it. We'll make sense of it later on. I am a member of the DGA, so I could say, well, you know what, I'm going to volunteer for what is not the it's kind of grunt work here, but I'll do some heavy lifting here, and hopefully at the end of it we'll have, honestly, it's not even overture, it's more like a prelude to the rest of the series, trusting that no one really would be able to figure that out except me and a few other trusted advisors on the show.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, one of the things that you have in that first episode is the first walk in space.
Yes, Ed White's walk in space.
So how did you stage that?
Well,
this is a scene where the an astronaut's in space attached by like an umbilical cord to the spacecraft.
Yes. There were five things that needed to be proven before anybody could go to the moon. And one of them was that it was going to be possible for a human being to get outside of a spacecraft in the vacuum of outer space. That a suit could be developed and that he would be able to live and breathe and survive however long it took, because obviously you can't walk on the moon without getting outside of the spacecraft. So this was something that had never been done before except by Alexei Leonov a few months prior to Ed White. And this was always one of the big things about the first episode. We were going to show this in such a way to an audience, by the way, that has become, you know, honestly, they've seen this 100 million times in any number of science fiction films or television series. That is, if we're going to try to bring it back in a oddly operatic, poetic, balletic sort of fashion, so they understand that, wow, now wait, that's a cool thing to understand, that the idea of opening a hatch as you're flying 5 miles a second, you know, 200 miles above the planet Earth, and then getting out and drifting around on a gold umbilical cord would probably be a very beautiful thing. As it turns out, it was very uncomfortable. It was very physically demanding of Ed White. It was not an easy thing to do. But you know what? We just sat down and said, okay, how are we going to do this? And it's a sequence that has almost every one of the current modes of special effects photography in it. We do models. There is some computer-generated animation. There is a stuntman that's hanging from a tether. There is a stuntman standing on a floor as the camera does some interesting things. And we just sort of like figured it out, a way to get from that hatch opening up to the final moments when he gets back inside.
You know, it's funny. I think our ideas of space have been formed at least as much by movies like 2001 and TV series like Star Trek as by the actual flights. And Tom Hanks, I read that you saw 2001 22 times in a theater.
Well, it's now over 30. It's over 30 now. As a matter of fact,
this was long before you started making space movies.
I've seen it projected. That's the big deal. I have it on Laserdisc, and I've watched sequences of it. But yeah, I've seen it projected. As a matter of fact, it was just re-released about 2 years ago, and it played in the Cinerama Dome here in Los Angeles. And I was one of about 42 people at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, sitting in and watching again. And lo and behold, I see something new every time I see the film.
So. What'd you see in it initially that got you back 22 times? Before you started seeing it,
I can tell you quite easily. It was the two sequences of the flight of the Pan Am space shuttle to the Blue Danube, and then the flight of the Ares 1B mooncraft, also to the Blue Danube, that is carrying Dr. Hayward Floyd to the moon. The thing you have to remember, that what I consider about 2001 is that this was not a fantastic, impossible future that we were seeing, rendered by Stanley Kubrick. This was literally what was going to happen. All of the spacecraft, procedures that we saw these characters doing, riding around and upside down in a circular space station, strapped down in a space shuttle. This was the physical reality of the direction that the hardware was going. We weren't seeing like rocket ships that were shaped like disc. We weren't seeing Lost in Space with the Space Family Robinson. We were seeing where the next generation of the Apollo spacecraft and the shuttle was. So this we were literally having a window into the future of what it was going to be like within our lifetimes. Yeah. I remember thinking, I'm going to be 44 in the year 2000, yeah. And that means by that time we'll be able to watch that space station go over our house, yeah. And it's going to look just like that because that's what it's based on in physics. And this is the reason that I went back again and again and again and again, because I was seeing in real life, I was looking at the first draft of 2001 A Space Odyssey in the form of Apollo's 8 and Apollo 11 and Apollo 12. And this was just going to be a few years in the future.
Tom Hanks, your HBO series From the Earth to the Moon not only chronicles the success of the Apollo missions, it chronicles, the failures. And I'm wondering what some of the failures were with making the TV series. In other words, some of the special effects that went bad, some of the little disasters on the set as you were making the movie.
Well, we had the reality is we were shooting our lunar surface sequences in a huge Zeppelin hangar in Tustin, California. 38,000 square feet of lunar soil, all sorts of different it was just the biggest place you've ever seen, and we found that when we put these stuntmen, it was usually stuntmen that were actually in the suits. We had actors come down for very specific scenes so that they would be incorporated into it, but the stuntmen could only take about 2.5 hours inside these suits. We had them attached to huge helium balloons. This is a big thing that we went through on the series, that I didn't want our lunar surface sequences shot in slow motion. If you look at the video, which I have extensively of the actual missions, everything happens in real time. They move their hands in real time, and the only thing that is oddly different is that they have this kind of gait that is allowed them by the 1/6 gravity. But other than that, it just looks odd. It doesn't look in slow motion. So we had various stuntmen attached to huge helium balloons that were helium balloons. I mean, the Zeppelin hangar is, I don't know, how is it? It's like 6 stories tall on the inside. It's a big, massive deal. It's as big as a Zeppelin, I guess.
It's enormous.
Actually, it's a little bigger than a Zeppelin. Otherwise, you couldn't get a Zeppelin in it. And so we had these black helium balloons that were 50 feet in the air and huge ropes or cords that were attached to special harnesses on them. And they were in these very heavy and bulky and hot recreations of the actual lunar EVA suits. And the poor guys, it just beat them to death. They just couldn't take it for more than 2.5 hours. And it's very slow moving the equipment. It's very slow setting up the shots. So what we were hoping to get in 15 days of lunar surface photography turned out to be 30 days because literally the human beings couldn't take the punishment.
What did you learn from Apollo 13 about how to and how not to shoot space scenes?
Well, actually, inside the command and lunar modules, it's really not that difficult because, honestly, we were on teeter-totters or just standing on apple boxes, and you can tilt the camera to make it look anything. You can do a lot inside these very controlled atmospheres. The real mold that we broke on Apollo 13, I think, was truly trusting the audience to understand what we're talking about. There is a philosophy that says, look, the audience doesn't know anything about orbital mechanics, so we can't hang any dialogue talking about orbital mechanics. Yes, we can, because it's going to be like, they see a movie in French and it's subtitled. After a while, they forget that they're reading the subtitles and they're just hearing the French, but they're understanding it. The idea of, okay, rocket ship, go! Retro rockets, fire! we had a lot of, we got the IDC aligns, we're going to have, we had the whole lessons about what gimbal lock is. The audience didn't need to understand gimbal lock. They just had to know that gimbal lock was a bad thing. And we were able to communicate that after a number of forays into the transcripts.
My guests are Tom Hanks, the executive producer of the new HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, and Andrew Chaikin, the author of A Man on the Moon, which the series is partly based on. The series begins Sunday. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Tom Hanks, executive producer of the new HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon about the Apollo space program, and Andrew Chaikin, the author of A Man on the Moon, which the series is partly based on. You know, I've often wondered how astronauts have been changed by the experience of being in space. And Andrew Chaikin, your book ends with, toward the end, there's a description of that. It's a question I think you asked a lot of the astronauts, and some of the answers were pretty interesting, like Pete Conrad told you that he always used to just say to people when they asked, how did it change you? How was being on the moon? He'd say, super, I really enjoyed it.
Well.
And Stu Roosa said, space changes nobody. He was in Apollo 14.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the most intriguing questions to me when I started writing the book, because I always felt that if I got to go, you know, it would blow every fuse in my head and would just come back with a completely new set of wiring. And I found, to my disappointment sometimes, before I really got to understand these guys, that quite a few of them took the experience in their stride. I think the misconception that a lot of people have is that the astronauts were emotionless, that somehow they were robots or they were just, you know, right stuff fighter jocks who just were, you know, doing the job and just, you know, brushed it off. That's not the case. Even a guy like Pete Conrad, who you quoted there. Now, Pete's an interesting guy. The day he got selected to be an astronaut, he said to himself, if I get to go to the moon, it's not going to change me. Now, I can't think of too many people who would decide that 7 years in advance. And then he got to go. And I think for him and for a lot of the guys, it was a professional thrill. It was a thrill to be on the moon. It was the ultimate test flight. But then they came back, and he's still Pete Conrad. And it's not, he doesn't go out and look at the moon and feel awe. He doesn't do any of that stuff. Then you've got guys like Jim Irwin, who flew on one of the later missions, came back from the moon and said he had felt the presence of God there. And, you know, only he lived for another 20 years after he came back from the moon. And every one of those years he spent going around the country as a Christian minister. He became an ordained minister and shared his faith by way of his moon tales, you know. There was the thing that I loved about interviewing these guys was that there was a whole range of responses, and some of them were sort of in the middle, you know. Bill Anders on the flight of Apollo 8, the first man to see the Earth rise. He took that famous photo that we've all seen of the Earth coming up beyond the moon and said to me that he could see with his own eyes that Copernicus was right, that the Earth was not the center of the universe. And that is a very powerful realization, but he didn't go off and become, you know, they kind of slough it off. He says, I didn't go off and become an environmentalist, you know. And in fact, he went off and became head of General Dynamics. So the range of responses is almost as great as probably any other group of people. It's just that we're starting with a group that comes through some very narrow filters. So there's some interesting things mixed in.
Tom Hanks, did you get to talk to a lot of astronauts about their experiences and how it changed them?
Yes, I did. Starting with Jim Lovell and eventually getting around to as many as I could honestly collect. What I have found is that they just came back more of who they were when they left, you know. Al Bean on Apollo 12 was probably, he dallied in art at the time, you know, a little bit of painting. And now he's dedicated himself he wants to paint 200 paintings, and much like Monet painted the water lilies, he's painting the lunar surface, and they're actually quite extraordinary paintings. My favorite in a lot of ways is Gene Cernan, who was the commander of the last lunar mission, Apollo 17. Gene is a man who can talk for a long time about what it was like to be
true.
In space. He is a guy, and you know what? He loves it. You know, you can ask him a question, hey, Gene, what was it like to walk on the moon? He could fill 2.5 hours with that alone, without even breaking stride. He had a great anecdote that he shared with me when I was talking to him, because I wrote the last of the episodes. And he said, Tom, he says that a lot, you know. Terry, he said, Tom, I just can't wait to hear what he says. He says, I looked up. He says, I was there monkeying around with a fender, you know. He had to fix a fender because he broke a fender on the lunar rover, and he's taping it up. And I looked up at the Earth just right over there over the South Massif, you know, over this big, mad, jagged peak that's up there on the moon. And he says, I could see that the sun was going down in England and it was lunchtime in Houston. I said, well, shoot, Gene, you were like standing on a time machine. You were literally looking at the time and space could do. That's right, Tom. I was having an adventure right there in time, space, and reality. Now you can wash this off as, you know, a degree of bluster from a guy who's very good at public speaking and also very proud of what he's achieved. But it doesn't take a lot of imagination to put ourselves in the same thing. That, look, we've all become used to looking at photographs of the ball of Earth, and it's this blue and it's green and it's brown and it's white and it's lovely. But we understand that's everything that we are and who we are and what we know. But also that you're looking at it from a point of view where you can see that people are going to bed in London and they're just sitting down to lunch in Houston with a casual glance of your eye. And that puts it in a perspective for me that makes all of these guys extremely unique.
Tom Hanks is the executive producer of the new HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. Andrew Chaikin is a series consultant and author of A Man on the Moon. Tom Hanks will be back with us to talk about his movies in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.